Morning, Oregon, and happy Friday. I'm Finn J.D. John, FJ at OffbeatOregon.com, and this is the Daily Offbeat Oregon History Podcast. Thanks for joining me, and I hope you enjoy the show today. This story was first published on November 9th, 2025, and it's part two of a two-part presentation on the Shanghaiing scene in 1890s Portland. The headline: Portland was Shanghaiing capital of the world in 1890s. Here we go. In yesterday's episode, we started talking about how crimping works as basically a forced indebtedness scam to keep sailors working and extract their money from them. We're continuing that explanation today. Going back to our illustrative story, let's say that the crimp sells the captain of the Flying Prince the services of 11 of the sailors who arrived in port a week or two before on the German bark Burgermeister Meisterburger, collecting a blood money premium of $50 each for delivering them. And the sailors who arrived on the Flying Prince sit around watching happily as their old ship stands out across the bar and away for the 11-month journey back to Old Blighty without them. Now, you would think that the captain of the Flying Prince would be beside himself with rage at having to pay all this blood money to replace all these truant sailors. He is not. He's delighted. You see, all those sailors who stayed behind are now technically deserters. As such, they have forfeited all the pay that they have accumulated on their voyage from Liverpool. In the 1890s, sailors earn roughly $30 a month, and they've been at sea for 11 months so far, so that's $330 per deserter that the captain just gets to keep. The captain doesn't in the least mind even a heavy blood money expense, plus another dozen or $2 in room and board, when he's got 3.5 sea notes with an abandoned wages to offset it with. A few weeks go by. Our sailors from the Flying Prince have settled into their life of ease in the boarding house. Let's follow one of them, a young tar named Jack Pringle. Jack has just finished his supper, a thin, moderately grim stew that is nonetheless princely fare compared with what he gets at sea, with bread to dip in it, when the boarding master, Larry Sullivan, steps up beside him.
"Jack, my boy, it's time for you to go back to sea," says Larry affably. "It's been great having you here, but all good things must end sometime. The Sea Witch is weighing anchor at dawn, and I need you to join her crew."
"I can't sail now," Jack cries in dismay. "Give me another week. I'll walk right down and sign up for the next one. And as it's the Sea Witch, old Bully Waterman's ship, I want nothing to do with that brute."
Larry surreptitiously eyes Jack, sizing him up. He's a 6-footer, untrained but capable of doing some damage in a fight, if nothing else by falling on him. Larry, a former prize fighter, knows he can force Jack back to the ship, but he might pick up a shiner or lose a tooth. It's not worth it.
"Oh, well," Larry says, clapping Jack on the shoulder. "We'll get you onto the next one. Times aren't so hard just now. Come, let's have a drink together. I won't even put it on your bill."
The sailor and the crimp stroll up to the little house bar, and Jack watches as two tumblers are poured half full of rum, one for him and one for Larry. But he notices that one of the tumblers has a little pile of powder in the bottom. This isn't his first rodeo, and he knows what that means.
"Hey!"
he shouts, and then stops. Larry has a pistol out and pointed straight at him.
"Pick it up and drink it," Larry orders.
Jack does, and the next thing he knows, he's waking up in a berth in the forecastle of the Sea Witch. So that's crimping, essentially a human trafficking operation using forced indebtedness to keep the sailors trapped in the loop while boarding masters and corrupt ship captains swindle them out of their wages. Shanghaiing is essentially freelance crimping. When the boarding house is empty of sailors who can be forced to go to sea to pay their room and board, the boarding masters and other freelancers just go out in the town, prowling for some naive plowboy or incautious logger that they can strike up a temporary friendship with. Most often that friendship would end at a bar, at which point the boarding master would dope his new friend's drink, or the bartender would, on the boarding master's orders. It's impossible to tell the difference between a sailor who's passed out after having too much to drink and a drugged Shanghaiing victim when his shipmate is helping him back to his berth on the ship. On a Saturday night in waterfront Portland circa 1895, lots of both kinds of unconscious men were being conveyed to the forecastles of grain fleet ships by helpful-looking lads. Some were fellow sailors helping their shipmates. Some were shanghaiers helping themselves. By the way, shanghaiers almost never used blackjacks or saps like they do in the movies. It's just too hard to clobber a man with just the right amount of force. Too much and you lose your blood money prize and are at serious risk of a murder rap. Too little and you've got a bad fight on your hands against a very angry opponent. Drugs were mostly used. There's also some anecdotal evidence that some taverns were rigged like mouse traps to catch sailors as well. There also is anecdotal evidence that there were basement cells used to keep shanghaiing victims on ice until shortly before a ship's departure time, when the captured sailor would be forced to take a drug at gunpoint and again wake up on board ship. As the 1890s ripened into the 1900s, the Portland shanghaiing scene shifted. For one thing, master shanghaier Larry Sullivan figured out how to cut the captains out of the deal by pulling strings to get the sailors arrested for petty crimes just before sailing time so that they would be stuck in jail when the ships sailed. When that happened, the captains had to leave the sailors' pay behind for him since he wasn't technically deserting. This resulted in international incidents and sanctions against the Port of Portland, all of which are more than we have time to delve into here. But if you're interested in more information about that, you can go over to offbeatoregon.com and go to the directory of stories and do a search for Larry Sullivan. Throughout the whole time, the crimping and shanghaiing scene marched on. If anything, it got worse as the years went by.
I will state that there is one port on the Pacific coast that has always been the greatest crimping den in America,
Andrew Furuseth, the president of the International Seamen's Union of America, testified to the U.S. House of Representatives in 1911.
I refer to the Port of Portland.
The glory days of crimping in Portland ended not with a bang, but with a whimper. By 1915, when the federal government passed the relatively toothless Seamen's Act, the practice was mostly history anyway. The grain fleet had switched over almost entirely to steamships, which were a lot more pleasant to live on. Plus, any mariner who had a berth on a steamer was loath to risk leaving it and checking into a boarding house lest he miss his sailing and end up crimped back onto one of the remaining sail-powered ships. As for shanghaiing, it was well known among hobos and tramps in the 1920s and into the 30s that one had to be very careful near the waterfront. The last sail-powered freighter wasn't built until the late 1920s, so they were still around. Somebody had to crew them. Nobody wanted to. But for the most part, shanghaiing was a dying art by 1920. Key sources in this story included works by Barney Blaylock, George Kramer, and Richard Dillon. Well, that's our show for today. Thanks again for listening. And by the way, if you haven't yet, check out our Offbeat Oregon books. They're a lot like these columns, only expanded and updated to take advantage of a less restrictive format. We've got Heroes and Rascals of Old Oregon, Love, Sex, and Murder in Old Oregon, Bad Ideas and Horrible People in Old Oregon, and eventually the plan is for 8 of them to be out, although how many there are out right now depends on when you hear this. They're a lot of fun and would look great on your bookshelf. This podcast is part of Offbeat Oregon History, a public history resource for the state we love. Check out our hub page at offbeatoregon.com to explore all the other things we do or to find the full citations and visuals that go with today's show. Our theme music is by the Atlas String Band and was written by Carmen Ficarra. Listen and download more at atlasstringband.com. Offbeat Oregon History episodes are uploaded every weekday morning at around 6 a.m., so it'll be a couple of days before you get your next fix. But of course, Monday morning will be here before we know it. And that's the latest news from here in Offbeat Oregon's Sulphur Springs studio. So now it's time for you and me both to go out there and fill up the rest of the day and the weekend with good stuff. Bye now.